So, lecture 11, September 27th, 2023. Lecture notes, pages 91. You should take note, if you haven't already taken note. This now begins the material that will be on, well, mini test, what, 6, I guess. And this begins the material for midterm 2. So, prior to today, midterm 1, today and onward for a while, midterm 2. So, you know that. Mini test 5, the last of the material on midterm 1, is open through Sunday, 11:59 p.m., covering lectures 9 and 10. Midterm 1 opens Sunday, so depending on your timing, you can work that how you want to. It opens at 8 a.m. on Sunday, stays open to Wednesday at 6 p.m. Through Proctorio. It covers all the material in lectures 1 to 10 and the textbook material, without any business or marketing in the news questions on it. We focus on content for that. We know that mini, enhanced earning extra credit and packback 3 close tonight at 11:59 p.m. I continue to get sort of favorable feedback on this new McGraw-Hill Connect thing where you do the role play. It's a little gamification, a little silly sometimes, but so far the feedback has been pretty good on it, maybe better than just those questions and answers. We'll see what the next offering is. And then we open the next version of that tomorrow morning, and it runs until Wednesday, October 4th. Midterm exam opens this Sunday at 8 a.m. You take it on Proctorio. It closes at 6 p.m. Webbies, wake up, please. 6 p.m. on Wednesday, not 11:59 p.m. 6 in-class students, 6 p.m. Why do I do that? Because inevitably somebody waits last minute, there's problems, they want help, and I'm not going to help you at 11:59 p.m. on a Wednesday, I'm sorry. So 6 p.m. gives me time to react and help you out if you waited till the last minute. Make sense? Sort of. 17% of your grade, what's covered in mini test 1 through 5, 50 questions, 80 minutes, so it's timed. Open book, open notes. You should have your book with you. You should have your notes with you. I guess I'll warn you up front, somewhere here I might have said it. The test is going to ask you to show your book and show your notes so I can see what you're using. It records it, so if I have any questions, I can go back and look at it, so don't be surprised when it does that. Sometimes, by the way, it's amusing. I watch students say, oh, my book, my way. I have to go get, they got their book because they forgot it was open book. So it helps them out to remember to have their book with them. Can't use any digital material we've talked about before. Start with a fresh reboot of your computer. Don't have anything else running except for the test itself. That'll save you some trouble. If you have questions, take the sample Proctorio World History quiz, and you'll see how that works prior to the exam. Don't need a code or a password. Just start with a clean whatever. Can't have printed material. Can't use digital material. Study for the test. Somebody said, I'm really worried about the test. I said, well, study for it. Said, oh, yeah, I'll study for it. So do that. Okay, questions today from anybody on the midterm coming up? What it covers, how you take it, anything else? Yo, a question, there, a question, I'm so excited.
We have our election as for those who think it would still be important to have the textbook if we haven't done it.
Do I think it's important? So there's several ways to answer that question. If I were doing it, I would want the textbook because I'm old, see now, I can't remember all that stuff. You might be younger. It's going to take you longer or shorter, I guess, depending on how you treat those questions that are pure textbook questions. Yeah, I'm being silly a little bit. Would I have lecture notes there if I didn't have the book? Absolutely. It's going to help you with some, and there's some overlap.
There's questions that relate to the textbook, but not the lecture
notes. Absolutely. So, again, it depends on how you've seen the mini tests in your mind. Every mini test draws, I promise you, 6 questions from the textbook. 4 questions from lecture / marketing business and news. To the extent you've been looking at that and go, boom, 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 I got it, I guess you're going to be okay. To the extent you've been looking at that and go, I don't know what that one is. I don't know where that. So some of the questions are pretty specific because they're from the book and it's open book. Will you fail without the book? Possibly not. Are you going to get a 90%? I'd be surprised. You'll let me know later on. So, yes, definitely if you have the lecture notes, at least have those with you, yeah? By the way, study those. If you don't have the book, physical copy, do you have the McGraw-Hill version? Well, at least do some studying of that. You might actually see the question that will be on the test. I don't know what else to tell you. Does that make sense? A little bit. What else you got?
Do
Oh, another question. Matt, I'm going to walk up here. Don't trip my wire and knock me out here. It lets you know your grade right away. And there's no reason not to in some sense because, again, it's a random draw of a large number of questions. So even though it's open for like 4 or 5 days, you aren't going to share many answers with too many other people because it's a random draw. So, yeah, you'll know right away. Keeping in mind whatever grade you got is probably lower than you expect, but there'll be a curve added to it, at least if life is typical. Yes?
Is there any marketing
news on the term? What? There's not. There's no marketing news or business news. We're going to focus just on content. Okay, what else we got? Yay. Okay, midterm grades will be posted. They'll be posted based on the results of midterm one exam plus the 5-minute test. About 36% of your grade going to the midterm grades. So how many guys, oops, I'm sorry.
What chapters will be on the exam?
It's going to be the material that is covered through mini test 5, which is chapter 1 through the end of chapter 4. Yeah, so just check what it says for midterm 5.
Got it.
And also in the last email I sent, are you getting email from me on a regular basis or no?
Yeah.
Because sometimes you can block those. So it's literally in that last announcement I sent, so just specifically the page numbers.
Got it.
Yo.
Average grade,
unfortunately, because people don't have the book, et cetera, is 68%, typically. So the curve, we actually had this little chat before, the curve is typically 5 points-ish. So my logic is, what would you expect a large group of people like this to get in the course? It wouldn't be 90, it wouldn't be 80, it wouldn't be 60. So I have chosen, if I need to give a curve, and I always have, to bring the curve to 72%, which for me is, you know, if all other things were equal, would you expect the math class about that, maybe? And almost always, there are students that get, with that curve, over 100%, meaning it's certainly doable, just everybody didn't choose to do it. Other questions? Yo, it's question and answer day. You just don't want me to get to any new material for the day. Yo. Say again?
It's only one attempt.
Yes, there's only one attempt, and as somebody said, and I had to mention, it's an individual attempt. You didn't tell me it was individual. Yeah, well, now you know. Individual attempt, not a group effort, and one attempt of it. Yep. Okay, other questions? That's the most questions I've had in a long time. Yeah, you. So many guys know Snoop Dogg. One person knows Snoop Dogg. I'm in the wrong. What error am I in here? How many people like Snoop Dogg? Say again? Thank you. Well, so does apparently a lot of the American population regards their demographic. Interestingly, boom. Grubhub in the Snoop Dogg to help with stagnant sales. Grubhub's answer to stagnant demand is more Snoop Dogg. The food delivery brand is putting the rapper in U.S. advertising, extending a campaign that has been nearing globally since 2020. So we're seeing corporate growth strategies via market development. What is that? Selling existing products to new customers. Global marketing, they've been doing it elsewhere, now they're bringing it here. Brand spokesperson and celebrity in advertising. Did Somebody Say campaign features Snoop rapping about various delivery scenarios. Chicken wings to the crib, wontons on the catamaran, tacos to the chateau, you can tell I'm not a rapper. Buying a slice on the side of the hot tub. So there's the ad message. Let's see if we can pull up the ad itself, see if it appeals to you. Really? You can't just show it to me, huh? Yeah, I got it. Oh, boo. Well, maybe we're not going to see it that way. Did I save it another way? Say again, do what? All right, now can we get the audio with it? We can, thank you.
JC, hungry dog, gotta eat. I get mines every day, every week, chicken wings.
There we go.
Did somebody say Grubhub?
Me, get delivery like a JC. Hungry dog, gotta eat. I get mines every day, every week, chicken wings to the crib. I'm sitting in, burger in the low. Hope they get the pickle in. wonton on a catamaran. Oodles and noodles, thank you, my man. Tacos to the chateau. Please, did somebody say Grubhub? Private jet in the night sky. My man hand glide by with my fried rice. Why? What could you not love? Bought a slice on the side of the hot tub. Ooh, see the crowd go nuts in the middle of the show for some donuts. Anytime, any zone. What you gonna do? Whoa, chocolate fondue right on
show. All right, we got enough of that to get the point. And there's Snoop rapping his message about using Grubhub. So the campaign has been running in 19 international markets, including Europe, Canada, Australia. Since 2020, Grubhub decided to bring it to the States after it boosted brand sentiment, read attitude, consumers' attitude, and orders, read purchase, you know, purchase, globally. In the UK, for instance, the campaign led to a 50% lift in brand awareness. That's a big lift. People don't buy things that they aren't aware of. 50% more people knew about it than before. With a 98% net positive sentiment, according to Grubhub Senior VP of Growth and Marketing. So we're seeing advertising boosting what we would want it to do, awareness, attitudes, purchase. Well done, Grubhub with Snoop. Snoop did so well in other markets that we wanted to bring this American icon home. She added that Snoop resonated across ages, demographics, and geographics in market research. We've not seen a thing as too much Snoop Dogg. So marketing research to understand consumers. Snoop's Grubhub ad will run on linear and streaming TV, social media, and out-of-home ads. Grubhub is also running a sweepstakes. Fans can visit Grubhub's social media channels to enter the hashtag did somebody say Grubhub sweepstakes by entering their favorite line from the rap from September 28th to October 2nd. So it's a real thing. You guys can sign up. Let me know if you win. Grubhub will do several giveaways where winners will receive a $500 Grubhub gift card. So here's the media plan. Here's sales promotion. That is the giveaway, the sweepstakes. Grubhub's reliance on the wrapper comes at a time when the delivery platform has lost market share to larger rivals DoorDash and Uber Eats, so we're seeing competition in the marketplace. But all of the delivery platforms are contending with tighter food budgets and inflation. Consumers are also opting to pick up their food to avoid the higher delivery fees. So here's an impact of a crest factor, the economy, on consumers and on businesses. So go Snoop. We just wrapped up B2C, so this is, of course, a B2C ad. We're going to get into B2B, so here's a B2B story. B2B firms that make an explicit promise have a 48% more chance of increasing brand health. Making a direct promise to the customer, I've never actually seen the acronym or whatever letters PTTC before, but promise to the customer in a campaign makes it more likely to be successful in driving brand health, market share, and long-term sales, according to new research from LinkedIn B2B Institute and Work. So understanding B2B consumers, marketing research and business, the research finds campaigns that make a direct promise to the consumers are 60% more likely to report increased market share than campaigns that don't do that. They also 17% more likely to report increased market penetration. Perhaps most interestingly, however, is that a campaign with an explicit promise to the at the heart of it was found to increase brand health metrics by as much as 48% more than a campaign without one. So here's the impact of good marketing. There are three distinct promises brand can make to a consumer, according to this research. Better quality and value, being easier to use, or being able to say this product will make you feel something different. This boils down to whether it's valuable, deliverable, and memorable. So here's the key campaign components from this research for your B2B ad campaign. LinkedIn and Work discovered that only 40% of campaigns make a promise to the customer. That's really incredible. 60% of the campaigns are not making a really tight, explicit promise to the customer about the value they will deliver for that customer. Day one, chapter one, marketing, creating value for the customer. Hello, anybody paying attention to the book, what we've been talking about, marketers? Starting Banks, Helping Business Fly promise, the promise that Starting has tools to help your small business grow, was highlighted as a campaign that made a specific B2B promise and which then showed impressive signs of growth. Starting saw its awareness score grow from 57% to 70%. Businesses don't buy products they're not aware of. Let's see if we can see their ad without logging into Facebook or whatever.
Watch football all season long, live and cable free.
That's with not YouTube it. There we TV. Go.
Whether you're just taking off or up and running, Starling Bank, helping business fly.
So, a pretty explicit statement. We're going to help you to thrive, small business. The research shows this works well for smaller brands with a smaller marketing spend. When we looked at the lowest scores of created commitment, separated out the ones that made a promise to the customers and the ones that didn't, we saw you were 84% more likely to increase market share if your campaign has a promise to the customers at the heart of it, when you have a low budget, low channels, and a low number of channels and low duration. So, wow, if you are a small business that doesn't have a lot of spend, make an explicit promise to your customer. It looks like it's going to work. So businesses, take advice. Finally, in addition to Snoop Dogg, I found somebody that you guys didn't know any influencers the other day, right, that I brought up from the screen. Anyone not know Olivia Rodrigo? Up. There you go. I can't please everybody. Bizarrely, I got this news story up yesterday, and on the way home on NPR radio, they were interviewing Olivia as 20 years old, the youngest person ever to win 3 Emmys, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's odd that the story is here, and she was on NPR radio. Olivia Rodrigo shows Sony how to make Gen Z headphones. Last year, Sony released its $200 Link Bud S wireless headphones as a go-between for its $280 WF-1000XM4 professional noise-canceling earbuds and its starter $100 WFC-500S models. Designed as a noise-canceling version of Sony's pre-existing Link Buds at $180, the Link Buds S were built so Gen Z users would never have to turn them off, switching from music to ambient noise to calls and back on activity. So we're seeing a new product introduction, so that's the P product in the mix, and price in the mix. We can see how they've separated their tiers by certain dollar amounts that they think will be meaningful to the consumer. It's more than a product, it's a lifestyle, says Maya Wasserman, Sony's Director of Marketing for Home and Personal Entertainment. It's supposed to be a product that stays with you all day. As Gen Z, well, actually, I looked around. How many of you guys wear headphones, a lot, earbuds, headphones, a lot during the day? So at first I was thinking, am I really going to convince you to wear it all day? And then I looked around, a lot of you are wearing it all day as it is, so maybe it's not a big stretch. Anyhow, but what if Sony's target users weren't accustomed to having buds shoved in their ears for most of their working day hours and didn't see how this product would change their minds? So my comment, ouch, the target audience doesn't get the product? How are you going to change their attitudes? Enter Olivia Rodrigo. After designing the LinkBud S by Olivia Rodrigo out of reclaimed plastic and giving them a marble pattern of her bespoke violet shades, so no two pairs look alike, Rodrigo and her producer Daniel Negro came up with a custom preset equalizer setting for Sony's Headphones Connect app that they felt yielded the best listening quality for both Guts and its preceding album, 2021 Sour. How many of you guys have listened to songs off of Guts? How about off of Sour? I think I heard that her single, I can't remember which one it was, top-selling recent single, had 1 billion downloads. Is that even possible, 1 billion? Obviously, she's popular. In Rodrigo, Sony saw a creator with a fervent fandom who not only wanted to attach her to her brand to a product, but provide the ideas that brought that product to life. When a brand is selling not only a product, but a shift in your daily routine, commitment is the core of the campaign. So we're trying to change consumers' attitudes and their behaviors. The campaign's ad flashes back to the house party from Rodrigo's Bad Idea Right video. Does anybody know the Bad Idea Right video? The house party? Will you recognize it when you see it? Here it comes at us, I believe. So they're playing off on a well-known
Kitty's legend. I am Paul Dano, and I play Roaring Kitty.
Where can I?
I don't think you...
So here she's trying on the buds. Or she can block you out. Listen, like Olivia, either to the music or to the quiet sounds. So they're making that point as best they can with her campaign. The product had 3D video billboards in Times Square and Shinjuku, Tokyo, a Universal Music Group unboxing, freebies for Rodrigo fan groups, and the ad across Hulu, YouTube, Spotify, Amazon's Thursday Night Football. So we're seeing the campaign launch strategy for this new product. Since LinkBud S launched, Sony brought in, how do you say that one? Cesa, Tate McRae, Saucy Santana, which one of those do you know? Which one? The first one? You know the first one? So here's the ad with Cesa making the same point.
Solitude and isolation. It's a blank page and a full mind. It's wanting to share myself and wanting to isolate. The solitude, it tests us, whittles us down until we allow it to make us stronger. It's necessary. Because now, I'm ready.
It's all about to my nerves.
So she moves the other way from quiet to the music. To show how they fit into each artist's world. Since July, however, Sony has been using its For the Music platform, most recently featuring Miguel, to imply that any artist who uses Sony equipment to make their music has forged a connection with the brand. These campaigns, above all, have served the same person as Rodrigo's, showing how to use the product in day-to-day life. So celebrity collaboration and, at this point, showing the value of the product to consumers. Obviously, we'll have to stay tuned and see how well this product does in the long run. All right, on to Lecture Notes, page 91, chapter 6, page 162 in the textbook. So I don't remember what I said earlier about what chapter we ended with for midterm 1. If I said chapter 5, I got it right because we're starting 6. Don't save. Oh, so as we ended up yesterday, I forgot to show this final slide. If you found any of this B2C consumer stuff, we do offer course card marketing 35035 consumer behavior, focusing on much more in-depth analysis of understanding the consumer. So now we turn to the other side of the house, which is the business side, understanding organizations as consumers, chapter 6, lecture note page 93, I guess. So we're still back in our strategic framework. We're still at the 30,000-foot level above the 4 P's of marketing and out to the marketing program. We're assessing our market opportunities. We've been assessing the B2C world so far. Now we're talking about assessing the B2B world, understanding organizations as consumers. So let's think a little bit about what we're talking about when we talk about the B2B world. We're talking about business marketing, yeah? The B2B marketing stuff. It involves the marketing of goods and services to companies, governments, not-for-profit organizations for their use in creation of goods and services that they can produce and market to others. And there's the big difference between them and you. When you buy a product, I presume, It's for your own personal gratification, to make you happy, to solve your problem. It's not so that you can produce and market whatever you bought to other people. If you did, then you're really a business. You're not a B2C market, right? So B2C is just you for you. B2B, they're buying it not to gratify themselves, but to create a product or service for other people. So this includes people and organizations that buy goods and services in order to make other goods and services. So that would be manufacturing is a business market. That include folks who buy goods and services in order to resell them without changing them much. So we're talking about wholesalers, distributors, retailers. They may repackage them. They may change bulk into smaller units. To conduct the organization's operations, so these are things that help you to do machine oil, toilet paper, toner, copiers, advertising agencies. All right, so in the past, we called business markets, quote, industrial markets, but of course today, manufacturing is a much smaller part of the economy than it used to be. We now have services too, so we've no longer called it industrial markets, we call it business markets. What are the components of the business market? Well, agriculture. Anybody grow up on a farm? Sometimes you get folks who grew up on a farm. So the challenge is to increase efficiency of that farm through what we call precision agriculture. My little video here shows us increasing efficiency, growing things bigger, and making money for that individual out on the farm. Resellers. Resellers sell products in essentially the same form that they get them. They create the utilities, though, for businesses, including time utility. Wholesalers hold those products out there for the B2B world until they need them. Place utilities, they get them to a warehouse near you so your business can use it. Information and possession utilities, so they're serving good value out to their business consumers. We talk about services to businesses, financial institutions, ad agencies, trucking firms, warehouses, tax services. So here we have H&R Block as an example of a service to the B2B world, as well as a B2C side, yes. And Felber and Felber Marketing, who specialize in services, advice for marketers in the business world. Government is a huge component. It makes up 35% of the gross domestic product. Things like airplanes, military, there goes a submarine that the government bought. Interestingly, the government is an interesting entity to sell to. It has a unique competitive bidding system. It's got lots of bureaucratic obstacles if you want to do business with them. The Sunday paper, the Cleveland Plain Dealer just had it, ran an article on why won't businesses bid on Cleveland's projects. And one answer is too much red tape, too many forms to fill out. It's not worth the time. There are entities, though, that would help you learn about the competitive bidding system if you want to sell to government. International trade, a big deal, a 200-ish trillion export business opportunity. And the government's going to have lots of programs to help you out when we talk about global marketing. We'll talk more about international trade. Here are the total trade dollars for the year, December 2022. So these are in billions of dollars. So it, in essence, reads $2 trillion in exports, $3.2 trillion in imports. So total annual trade in 2022, $5.4 trillion. Could you make any money off of some part of import or export at that amount? $4 point some trillion, maybe that, or $5 point some trillion. Maybe that's someplace you want to look at. Here I'm just showing you what happened to exports, where they actually dropped from 2019 to 2020 because of what went on with COVID. Also, imports dropped, so the overall total annual trade was hit hard by COVID, as you might expect. Total trade in 2022 of all countries. So who do we do business with as of 2022? Number one partner, Canada, Mexico, China, Japan, Germany are the top five. And let's see if this current actually takes us to the current today. Yeah, I was hoping it would give me the list of the top people. But they changed stuff, so not that important. I was just curious what the top ones look like today. Yeah. All right, so they're probably quite similar today as they were in 2022. Non-business or not-for-profit organizations. So we market to charities, other not-for-profit organizations, religions. These firms do everything that a for-profit firm does, and so these entities do require professional management, and they have to know how to buy products.
Yeah, a lot.
So here we hear from our good friends out at Timken, who, of course, are B2B marketers marketing tapered roller bearings and steel, talking about this element.
Yeah, a lot of people are surprised about the growth prospects for us. In fact, would say looking back 20 years, business has never been better. The industries that we've focused upon, and part of this goes back to industries are willing to pay for the value we create, and not all industries see the differentiation we can provide. But the ones that do, and they tend to be heavy industries, and I'll name a few, you know, the steel industry, power generation, cement production, aggregate, many other heavy, wind energy is a new one for us that is growing leaps and bounds, and those are the kinds of energies we've targeted because those industries, we feel we can deliver value to the customers in those industries, and it just so happens those industries are all going great guns right now around the world. I think as anyone understands who picks up a newspaper these days, anything that's dug out of the ground is red hot right now. Iron ore, coal, you name it. I mean, the energy industry, oil exploration, another key industry for us. So it's actually pretty surprising that most of the industries we serve right now are very strong. We see strong demand continuing. And, you know, one of the weak industries is the automotive industry in North America, which has been a stronghold of the Timken Company for a long time, a key industry. And it's one that we've really taken a hard look at, and we've said that, you know, again, for those customers who are willing to pay for the value we create, great. If they're not, it might be an industry we gradually diminish our focus on.
If you're running a high-speed train on a track in Europe somewhere where they go really fast, it's really important how your roller bearings work. You don't want to freeze up in a train going 250 miles an hour. The American auto companies don't really care that much about your roller bearings in your cars. They're not really willing to pay for the value that a Timken can bring to them. And so they've taken a hard look and said, is this really a business we want to continue working closely with? Because they don't really seem to appreciate our value. So there are a lot of organizations out there. We categorize them in other ways, but among what's called the NACIS sector, we'll get that to a little bit. So we see that we have agriculture, forestry, fishing, and hunting. The last time I had the numbers over there. Mining, utilities, construction, manufacturing, transportation and warehouse, information, finance, insurance, and real estate, services in general, and not-for-profit organizations. So about 15 million industrial markets out there. Reseller markets, wholesalers and retailers, about 2.6 million out there. And the government markets, around 260,000-ish. Where does Timken operate? Well, they operate in mining and utilities, construction, transportation and warehouse, transportation predominantly, and with government as well. So we see across the spread of potential customer bases, they focus on some and not on others. We do categorize all these different sorts of businesses, so we can think about them in groups, into two basic categorization schemes, the North American Industry Classification System, NACIS, and the North American Product Classification System, NACIS. And we can then go into the database and look up different sorts of things we might be interested in finding about. If we're in construction, what does that look like? Well, construction has residential building construction, non-residential building construction, utility system construction, land subdivision, highway, other heavy, etc., etc. And so we can dig down deeper and deeper to learn more about the sorts of businesses that operate in these various sectors of the business economy. I was told one time there was a local producer of rubber tubing, and they put the product out to market. Oftentimes, businesses don't know who buys their product, how they're using it. And they suddenly got questions back from the medical field. And they said, we're not really selling for the medical field. What's going on? Well, it turned out their tubing was appropriate for some medical situation. And so they were able to go back and research medical field, what's the subdivision, what's rubber tubing do there, and use a sort of classification to begin research on how they might be able to better serve that market. So it's this classification scheme lets you see who's out there, what their area is. In general, B2B companies have important differences from B2C companies, as you might imagine. B2B companies typically sell complex products and services, typically. And they do it through a complex, systematic purchase process. You put out a tender, which is your specifications and what you need from a company that's going to provide to you. You select the various vendors, you choose one, involving multiple stakeholders, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And it can take a long time, sometimes years or decades, to complete the sale. So you have to have a little patience if you're dealing in the B2B world. So what are some characteristics of this organizational buying situation? Well, one is something called derived demand. The demand for industrial products and services is driven by or derived from the demand for consumer products and services in general. Why? Because businesses are not buying products for their own gratification. Eventually, they're buying a product because some customer down the stream wants something that they're making. So, for example, what consumer products influence the demand for lithium batteries, glass, screens, and microchips? What would you guess that answer is going to be? Cell phones, smartphones, right? So companies are not buying glass, lithium batteries, screens, and microchips because they like them. They are buying it because downstream, there's a demand for, in this example, mobile phones. What does this imply? Well, it implies that business marketers actually have to understand the final consumer and their demand, even though they're not necessarily selling to that final consumer. I've even recently gone out and bought a microchip or two just to have a microchip. Not that many of us, but we have bought smartphones. So often what these business-to-business businesses need to do is to find ways to encourage sales of their buyer's product. So if I can get more people to buy phones, I sell more batteries, glass, screens, and microchips. So marketers do this. They're aware of this. They think about it. For example, Intel, Inside. You guys know that? Bong, 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 bong. Yeah. They, are, of course, were a chip manufacturer. And in the original days, nobody cared much about them. They're a chip. Who cares? I don't buy chips. I buy computers. So in the 90s, Intel launched a global marketing program to make people care about the microprocessor that they had in their computers. Marketing directly to the end user was a novel idea for a semiconductor company whose main consumer are computer manufacturers. Although the company was widely recognized among computer manufacturers, the brand had little name recognition among end users. So the task of branding the chip in a PC became known as, quote, Intel Inside, the world's biggest co-op advertising program at the time, reaching $1.5 billion in ad spending. So how would you really reach a standard everyday consumer with this idea that that Intel chips are important? Well, let's pick a good spokesperson for the everyday consumer. What?
For years, Intel technicians have been making PCs smarter. Now they face their greatest challenge ever.
Hey, no one messes with my brain until I get sprinkles. Suckers.
Now anyone can have all the brain power they want, Just look for a PC with an Intel processor inside.
By eliminating covalence inhibitors, we create triple-dense carbohydrates and thus the so-called super donut. Many of you mock my interest in the pastry sciences.
What do you have inside?
No! No! So who better to get that message across than Homer Simpson to the general public? So they actually build up some awareness, some thinking about it. The multi-million dollar campaign is the largest for Intel since Multiply, the September 2006 campaign that supported the then-new Intel Core 2 Duos. This is a new campaign. Sponsors of Tomorrow was expected to have a lifespan of 3 to 5 years, but it ran all the way out until 2013. Maybe you'll remember seeing something like this, perhaps. This was the idea of your rock stars on the left and our rock stars, these guys dealing with computer stuff on the right. And they played off on this too with an ad to get your attention. Wow, co-inventor of USB.
We are Intel, sponsors of tomorrow.
So that little note, bong, 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 is something that stuck with them and, you know, was an identifier for them. And today, Experience Amazing, we have to tell people about all these amazing things that Intel has been a part of. When we're working with the ad company, I was like, did you know that we were in the space shuttle and the Hubble telescope and Stephen Hawking's computer? Intel's been a part of all these huge cultural experiences, and we as a company never talked about them or tried to get credit for them. But we have to let people know, kids today don't care about what's inside, they care about what they get to do with it. That's been the impetus for this whole new campaign, although we're still gonna keep bong, bong, bong. Supposed to go bonk, 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 bonk. Anyhow, so we're trying to focus on the experience you get, but why would a computer chip company focus on all this consumer stuff? Because we want you to care about what's inside when you buy your product. Elasticity of demand is an important concept in the B2B world. Recall your microecon course, of course. Inelastic demand is when the total demand for all the producers of the product responds very little to changes in price. So regardless of whether the price goes up or down, there's little or no change in demand. So price does not affect how much is sold because of inelastic demand. This occurs when cost is a small percent of the finished product. So for example, in the 787 Dreamliner, they had 12,000 suppliers. They used, a whole bunch of rivets in their plane. But rivets are not a big cost of their plane. And so regardless of whether the price is up or down, there's not going to be a huge difference in the demand for rivets. You pretty much got to have your rivets, but you aren't going to buy a whole bunch more because the price went down. Pretty much inelastic demand. Also, you have inelastic demand when there are no close substitutes for the product. So when you have a higher price, you can't really go anywhere because there's not much to substitute it for. In the mid-1990s, the price of white bond paper went up 150%. This meant that in those days before computers were really a thing, all your marketing was done on mailers, on brochures, on coupons. White bond paper was a big thing for business back then. And in the short run, the demand for white bond paper didn't drop much. What were they going to do? They pretty much had to use what was available. But believe it or not, the change in paper actually helped demand increase among businesses for computers. Too expensive to use this bond paper. What else can we do? Let's get into the internet. Let's start using computers to do stuff. An interesting switch caused in part by that. So in the long run, there was more elasticity in demand, but in the short run, there were no close substitutes, and people just had to pay the price. Demand didn't drop very much. Demand's more elastic when we're looking at not the industry, but a single firm within the industry. So the demand curve for a single firm might be quite elastic. In my rivet example, they aren't going to buy a whole lot more rivets because the industry price dropped, but maybe your price for high-quality rivets, please, we're building an airplane. For high-quality rivets, maybe somehow you got your price down. For your firm, you might have elastic demand, lower price, more orders for your company. When demand is viewed from a long-term perspective, I just gave the example where in the short term, people still had to buy white bond paper even though the price went up, but over the long term, they shifted away to computers. So over the long term, demand can be more elastic. If you fashion students, where are my fashion students today? Fashion? No, one fashion student. So you're designing your new fashion line. What do you call it? New line of clothing. That's what I'm trying to say. And you have to plan in advance, right? You can't do today for tomorrow. You're planning it out. You've got it all laid out. And suddenly, what do you find? The cost of your cloth in your plan, it's all laid out, has jumped up. Can you suddenly redesign your whole line? Probably not. You're pretty well locked into that. In the short term, you probably have to stay with whatever the cost was and make it work. But there's no change over this season in demand for the cloth because you got to do it. But over the long term, you can say, wait a minute, that's gotten too expensive. So over the longer term, a higher price or new material may affect the order that you have next time around. So over the longer term, indeed, you become more elastic in your demand for that product. Also, it's more elastic when the product is a significant cost in the finished good. And so it's not rivets, it's something, in this case, oil makes up a large percentage of a lot of products out there. The price of oil changing can really change the demand for a product because it's a significant cost in what we're producing. Compared to B2C customers, B2B purchases tend to be well, that's not a good comparison. I'm getting to the point. All right. So there are a smaller number of businesses out there. There's 6 million employer establishments that have paid workers. There are 27 million non-employer establishments. That is to say, you own the company yourself. So there's about 33 million firms. I just shared the information, but about how many consumers are there in the U.S. population? How many people, roughly? How many? People in the U.S.? Yeah, a little more than 8. Yeah, there's around, depending who you look at, around 334 million people. 8 million firms, or 33 million firms, 334 million people. You can see the difference in trying to reach out to the groups of people, right? It's 10 times more entities to reach. So you have a different sort of marketing approach. And I like to do this just to see if my 334 is current, or if the population has changed. Let's pull up the population clock here real quick, see what it tells us the population is. Look at that. People have been busy. We're at 335 million population today. So we have quite a differences between B2B and B2C in terms of the number of potential buyers. The number of buyers is small compared to the ultimate consumer, but they have a lot of purchasing power. They spend a lot of money. Imagine how much money it costs to buy a new oil rig, a new airplane line, a new manufacturing plant. So there's a relatively smaller number of entities to work with, but their purchasing power is pretty big. They spend a lot of money on what they do. And from a marketing viewpoint, it's interesting to note that oftentimes these folks are concentrated. Even though the auto market has become more global over the last, 30 or 40 years, but where do you think of the U.S. auto companies being, if I'm phrasing that right? Where are they headquartered? U.S. auto companies? Thank you. Detroit, not Ohio. Detroit. So they're clustered in Detroit. If that is your business, you probably have to know that you need to be in Detroit. Goodyear's fate in the business market depends on them selling tires to just a handful of automakers, many of whom are clustered in Detroit. Yeah? This is a demo to show how things are clustered. The orange colors show the highest concentration of manufacturing. You can see here in the upper Midwest, we have quite a bit of manufacturing going on, and that's where you would concentrate your sales force, not so much in Nevada, for example, where we are not going to see much manufacturing. So who's your industry? Where do they cluster? That's where you're going to focus your marketing, your sales staff, etc. The organizations, as compared to ultimate consumers, differ in their buying objectives. Why do businesses buy from other businesses? Well, it's to help them achieve their objectives, which isn't to attract a mate, to feel better about themselves, to look pretty. Objectives such as reducing costs. If you can go to a company with your product and legitimately show them a way that your product is going to reduce their cost, you got their attention. Reduced cost, of course, means increased price, not price, but profits, right? Reduced cost in price, profit. Whoa, you have my attention. Tell me more about whatever you're selling. That's one of their big goals. Or if your product will cause them to sell more of whatever they're selling, people want more of it, increasing their revenues. Again, legitimately, you got their attention. That's one of their big goals. Or maybe their goal is to be more socially responsible, and your product can help them be more sustainable, be more socially responsible, use recycled products where they weren't able to use them before. So you get their attention. So these are things that business buyers are often interested in. We talked in the B2C model about evaluative criteria, things that influence your decision among alternatives that are out there. In deciding among suppliers, buyers have to consider a variety of factors such as, well, the price of the product to them, something you would consider. The delivery schedule. I need you to have your product at my production line on time, or at least in my warehouse on time, however I'm operating. You can't be telling me, oh, sorry, it'll be here next week. That's an important criteria for me. Past performance. How well have you been able to do things reliably to specs at the price you promise? The production facilities and the capacity. I'm planning to grow. I'm planning to go international. I'm planning to go to a new region. I'm planning to sell more product to existing customers. Can you do that? What do your facilities look like? Warranty and claim policies. Your product in my product causes problems for me. What's your warranty policy? Takata bags. What are those things called in a car?
Airbags,
thank you. The big word, you know, for an old guy like me. Takata airbags. Those guys failed a lot for a while, and I actually don't know what the answer was, but what was their warranty policy, their claim policy to help automakers cover the problems that they ran into? You'd want to know that. Technical capability. Can you come up with the computer chips, with the AI, whatever it is I need or want, can you do that? Those all become evaluative criteria. And can you meet my quality specs? Can you produce the product to the specs that I needed to work for me in my product? All important evaluative criteria. Most of those not something you're worried about as an ultimate consumer. Anybody know ISO 9000 from management or whatever? Have you heard of that before? That sort of thing, the ISO criteria? This is such a big deal. Your technical specs, these are standards for registration and certification of a manufacturer's quality management and assurance system based on an on-site audit of the practices and procedures developed by the ISO, the Internal Standards Organization. If you are ISO qualified, you have a guarantee of sorts from a third party to your potential suppliers saying, when I tell you that I keep my specs to your needs, I can do that. I'm ISO qualified. These guys are so excited about it, they're standing out in front with their big banner, they've been ISO qualified. So why is all this so important in the B2B world? Well, firms have to buy the right product, because it's gonna go into the product that they're selling to someone else, at the right time. We, as a group, as a classroom, you can't appreciate this idea of having things at the right time any more than you just lived through all the supply chain problems that we had in the last 3 years, 2 years ago. We're not having, because we didn't have the right product at the right place. The system was getting wonky at the right price, because companies in general are making less themselves and buying more from suppliers. Some are now questioning the wisdom of that decision making because of the supply chain problems we've had. Toyota, for example, buys $25 billion in parts and supplies annually rather than make them themselves. Firms cannot tolerate defective parts or supplies, and we know that the Takata airbags hurt the sales of cars over the time period that that was going on. We can't have it. So we get many companies still depend on the idea of just-in-time and just-in-sequence delivery. That is to say, I do not want to warehouse your product for months or weeks at a time in my warehouse. It's just sitting there costing me money. I want you to manufacture and deliver your product component to my line just when I need it. The idea would be there at the right time. If you don't, the supply chain gets wonky. So firms need to work with fewer suppliers and develop long-term relationships with them to be sure that they are doing the things that we need them to do. Right price, right delivery schedule, right tolerances. So we have relationships with these entities. They aren't just throwaway cogs in a wheel. So we need to work together to develop new products so you know what's coming as my supplier. You know that you can do the specs and the techs. Share information on inventory so you know when I'm running low. Share information on productions and costs so we can work together as a team to get this stuff done. Now, the supply chain problems caused by the COVID pandemic does have businesses wondering if they should change the way they're doing, thinking about this B2B relationship. See, just-in-time delivery.
Is the ability to refuel, relocate.
Enabling those operators to operate their existing satellites longer so they don't have to launch new satellites as soon.
There we go. All right.
Look at this, sold out. Can you believe this stuff?
So they were supposed to deliver it in October.
This is going to be an update on the kettlebell shortage of 2020.
I just want my shoe. Give me my shoe, please.
Then it was supposed to be November. No. Then December.
Give me my PlayStation. Am I wrong for wanting this, bro? I mean, everything just sucks lately.
Take my money. Take my money. I don't want it. Give me my shoe.
Every time I check my email, it's stuck on this right here. I don't even know what that means.
Tonight, one word sums up the feeling along every line of the supply chain: frustration.
Well, the shortages and delays in the global supply chain threaten a total paralysis.
When the pandemic hit, businesses anticipated that the COVID recession was coming. They thought that demand was going to drop, but something funny happened. The opposite of what all of these businesses and economists predicted happened. Demand exploded. People bought things like crazy. And now supply chains are choking on that record demand. Everyone has had the experience of not being able to get something. And everyone has had the experience of paying more for something.
So this whole thing built up in the minds of consumers, certainly, but also in businesses. Have we been playing this model right? Should we bring stuff closer to home? Should it be domestic? Should we be manufacturing it or not? So the environmental impact of this has businesses rethinking how they want to do this part of their business. Buyer-seller relationships and supply partnerships, ignoring COVID for a moment. Supplier development is the deliberate effort by organizational buyers to build relationships that shape suppliers' products, services, and capabilities to fit the buyer's need and those of its customers. So again, the idea of just-in-time and just-in-sequence is the idea that you need to understand my inventory, my demand, my production. We need to work together to be sure your stuff is where I need it. Maytag, if you are working with Maytag, they expect you to have on-site representation at their manufacturing plants. If there's any issues or problems, you got it covered as a supplier. So we have those relationships going on. when you buy a product, you buy it for yourself. And except in the case of the family, which I'm going to allude to in a minute, there's not a group decision going on. For many, many, many business purchases, it's a group decision. And that group is called the buying center. The buying center consists of a group of people in an organization who participate in the buying process and who share common goals and risks and knowledge that is important to the purchase decision. As a marketer to these people, you have to know about that. It's a cross-functional group, so you're selling You're selling a massive refrigeration unit that's going to go into a new construction site for a company. Well, you probably have to talk to the users there, the electricians there, the construction engineers that are involved, the shipping, how you getting the thing there, cross-functional team involved. The people in the buying center, you have to know who they are, what their individual backgrounds are, what their experiences have been, what agendas they might have if you're going to sell successfully to them. And this set of roles should sound a little familiar. It is very similar, well, identical, to what we saw in the case of the family. The gatekeeper. Now, in the family, the gatekeeper might be that college student who knows about computers. In a business, who's the gatekeeper? Depends on the particular business. Sometimes, if you're talking person to person, you go to the front door, hi, would you like any computers today? The gatekeeper might be the secretary at the front desk. Salespeople have to know the secretary, be in good shape with her. Treat her right, otherwise your card, oh yeah, Dr. Marks will be in sometime, I'll be sure to give your card to him. Trash. You have to have good relationships with the gatekeeper. Or it could be the engineer, it could be the purchasing agent. It's incumbent on you to know for your companies, for your clients, who's the gatekeeper. To allow that flow of information in about your new fantastic product, about the thing that's going to make them socially responsible, or cut their costs, or increase their revenue. Who's the gatekeeper? Second, of course, are the influencers who, like mom setting the budget, who is the influencer on this decision for this big company? Sometimes they're hidden from you. There was an example told to me one time in a big B2B purchase. The supplier thought they had a lock. They thought they were good. They thought they had sold it. They didn't get the sale. Why didn't they get the sale? Turns out that the president, who's the decision maker in this example, the president's wife didn't like the sales rep. Don't know that that's an influencer in this situation, but it was a big deal. And I don't know what the sales rep did to make the wife unhappy, but she was an unknown influencer. Who are the influencers here in your company? Is it the engineers? Is it the wife? The users? You have to know who those folks are. So you're down the manufacturing floor with your production, or you're over in engineering talking to them about how they're going to use your product. The buyers, sometimes the buyers are the key people. It's a minor product. The buyers are the people that are going to make the decision. They are often involved, though, in setting the contracts, setting up all those details that you've agreed upon with everybody else. Who's the buyer? What's their goals? And, of course, who's the decider? Who's the person that's going to say yes or no, as influenced by influencers, users, and buyers? Buy classes represent the, quote, type of buying situation in the B2B world. One approach is a straight rebuy. Straight rebuy are things that we know very well, we use fairly often, it's not a really big decision that's being made, like toilet paper, machine oil, paper towels, toner. Oftentimes, the only person involved in this is going to be the purchasing agent, the buyer. They have a computer program. They look up their top three suppliers. They choose the one that they used last time or the next one in the list. Boom, you're gone. It's actually hard as a marketer to get in on these straight rebuy situations because it's almost routine. We just go to the last one we used. A modified rebuy is a situation where something's a little different. There's a new version, there's a new vendor, there's a new product out there. It's not a massive change, but still, I might want to consider things. My example here with the book and the Apple is someone rolls out a new marketing textbook. So I'm not just rebuying the one I bought last time. I'm intrigued. Tell me more. Tell me what it is you're doing. What's your special online program? What's your test bank look like? So I'm going to do a little consideration, which I wouldn't do if it was just the same old, same old. Same thing in the business world. And then you have the situation of a new buy. You don't know who the players are. You don't know who the vendors are. You don't know what the criteria are. You don't know anything. We're going to have a new robotic production line. Or how about a new robotic instructor? Nothing could go wrong. So we don't know anything about that. So now we have to do an entire investigation. Who are the players? What are the criteria? What are the price points? What are the problems? That's a chance, of course, where new players can get involved because they don't know anything. So in the, just to restate it in a chart, in the straight rebuy, people involved, just one, usually the buyer. Decision time to buy new pencils, new toner, new toilet paper, pretty short. Problem definition, pretty well. I understand what you need. If you need new toilet paper, I got it covered. Buying objective is usually the low-priced supplier that, you know, provides the product we want. Suppliers considered, usually the present ones. Hard to get in on that. And the buying influence typically is going to be the purchasing agent who just looks it up and orders it. In the case of a modified rebuy, well, there are a couple people involved, right? New textbook, new machine oil. Decision time is a little more moderate. Problem definition is minor modifications. Buying objective might still be the low price supplier with this new situation. Suppliers considered, well, I'd change what it says there. I'd say present plus anybody new who's brought some new stuff to us in this modified situation. And the buying influence is going to be the purchasing agent plus a couple other people who are involved in this new situation. Finally, in the case of a new buy, well, we just don't know anything. So this is a big, complex deal. Lots of people are going to get involved in making a new decision about a robotic professor or a robotic production line. Decision time is going to be long. Problem definition is really going to be uncertain. We just don't understand this situation. Buying objective is not the low-price supplier. We want to get a good solution for this new situation. Suppliers would be both new and present suppliers. And the buying influence, well, is the whole buying center, technical people, operating people, financial people. So as a marketer, you have to understand what is the buy class situation? What are those people likely to need from you during that process of sales? This is a little bit overwrought example, but it's trying to demonstrate the difference between a B2C and a B2B decision-making process. Problem recognition stage for a consumer who wants a new smartphone. So the student doesn't like the features of their existing smartphone that they own right now. They want a new one. So we talked about information search in the B2C world. They use their past experience. They talk to friends. They look at ads on the internet. Consumer reports, they collect information and figure out what the good alternatives out there might be. Alternative evaluation, they evaluate these smartphones that they've come up with on the basis of important attributes to them, whatever it might be, camera, storage space, sound. They visit a couple stores maybe. Purchase decision, a specific brand of smartphone is selected, the price is paid, the student leaves the store. Do please pay for your phone before you leave the store. And post-purchase behavior, student reevaluates the purchase decision, may return the phone if it isn't very satisfactory. Contrast that with what happens in the business world. Here a business is deciding to create a new earbud headset for their smartphone. So first of all, marketing research and sales observe that competitors are improving their earbud headsets for their smartphones. The firm decides to improve their earbud headsets on their own new models, and they'll be purchased from an outside supplier, important. So now they're looking for a supplier. They begin to design and have production requirements, coming up with specs, and the purchasing department identifies suppliers out there who could meet these specs. Alternative evaluation, we get purchasing and engineering involved, and we have an assessment of the suppliers, their facilities, their capacity, their quality control, their financial status, and we drop anybody who doesn't seem to match that. Finally, we use those evaluative criteria to choose a particular vendor, and we negotiate our terms, we award the contract, and then we decide whether or not they do their job using a formal vendor rating system, and we notify the supplier if there's any issues or problems, and if they don't fix them, we drop them. A little more formal. situation than in the B2C world. An example of a B2B decision. How many of you guys know Hershey's chocolate? Yeah? We all know. Okay, we all know Hershey's. So Hershey's creates chocolate. They're a pretty good company. They sell chocolate. Well, they begin to recognize there's a problem out in the American public. Anybody know where I'm headed with this by any chance? Can you figure it out? What would the American public problem be relative to chocolate? Obesity and diabetes both are connected. So there are 18 million Americans who have diabetes and other health problems related to this sort of thing at a 10% growth rate annually. So consumers would like something that is chocolatey but won't drive their diabetes off the chart. So Hershey's begins to look around for stuff to fix the problem. They want a sugar substitute, but it has to be the right one. They don't want to make the wrong decision. So they define the specs for their sugar substitute. It has to appeal to consumers. It has to have the right taste, the right texture, their dietary needs. It has to work on their equipment. So it has to be easy to use. It has to be sufficient quantities available. It has to cost right. So they do information search. They come up with some alternatives. So marketing and production and research all jointly evaluate the alternatives that are out there. Maybe they even contact the university food service science researchers for more info. They eliminate any that don't have the taste and texture of sugar. They make their purchase decision. They buy the sugar substitute. They integrate it into their marketing mix for their new sugar-free products, and they market those products. And then they decide whether or not it works out. Does it do what it's supposed to do? And of course, as you know now, certainly, they have a whole line of sugar-free products, sugar-free chocolate syrup, Jolly Ranchers, Reese's, Twizzlers, Hershey's. And so they have made this decision work for them. And then we say, how well did our supplier do? And how successful are these new products in the marketplace? Those decision criteria come into play. All right, I'm getting tired of talking, and I can see you're tired of listening, so let's call it a break. Yay!